Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Congresswoman Sherry Bustos, who joins us to discuss this week's hearing to explore the Farm Bill's crop insurance title. But first, here's this week's headlines. The global food crisis took center stage during a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing Wednesday. According to David Beasley, who is the executive director of the World Food Program, 50 million people in 45 countries may face famine this year. He says the crisis could get worse next year because of possible reductions in farm production due to shortages of affordable fertilizer for production in Africa. In the U.S., domestic users of fertilizers got good news this week. The U.S. International Trade Commission ruled against duties on urea ammonium nitrate fertilizer imports. The commission's ruling found the imports, which are coming from Russia and Trinidad and Tobago, are not harming American fertilizer companies. Farm groups were relieved by the news after expressing concern over possible tariffs on the fertilizer. And finally, producers and crop insurance industry representatives spoke in front of a House Ag subcommittee about protecting the program from cuts in the upcoming Farm Bill. Witnesses were concerned by the idea of capping premium subsidies. A study released this week by the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition said that limiting subsidies to $50,000 per farmer would save more than $16 billion over 10 years and affect only 3.5% of farms. Illinois Democrat Sherry Bustos chairs the subcommittee that convened the hearing. When we spoke to Bustos, we asked her how lawmakers will address those concerns as they look to write the 2023 Farm Bill.
You know, I think you've got a lot of different opinions about this, obviously, with the witnesses, and you could tell by the line of questioning where some of the members were coming from on it. But here's where I come from. Being in the state of Illinois, we're corn country and soybean country. And going back many, many years, this is now my third farm bill that I've been involved with. And what I can tell you is after we went from direct payments to a robust crop insurance program, what I hear from our growers and producers is don't mess with crop insurance. And first, do no harm. It's kind of like that the oath that physicians take in delivering healthcare, but it is like first, do no harm. And so I just want to make sure that where we end up in the 2023 Farm Bill is to make sure that we've got a robust crop insurance program that in an environment that we're experiencing severe drought and severe heat and obviously climate change throughout not just our country, but from throughout the world. This is something that we have to make sure that we get in the right place. This is why I'm the chair of the General Farm Commodities and Risk Management Subcommittee of Agriculture, and it's why we are traveling around the country to find out what do our growers and our producers and our stakeholders want us to know. We just went to Arizona to Congressman Tom O'Halloran's district just last month. On Monday, I'm going to be heading to Minnesota to Congresswoman Angie Craig's district in Minnesota. We're going to Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur's district in Ohio next month, and then we're looking at a couple other stops along the way for these bipartisan listening sessions because we want to know what those on the ground want us to know. And I think that's the starting point that we have to have.
Mm-hmm. A lot of folks watching for climate discussions as part of the upcoming Farm Bill. Do you think those climate discussions should be in concert with crop insurance language, or do you think the two should remain separate?
Well, I think, you know, you really can't separate the two, right? I mean, we've got to have a strong safety net program, and obviously a strong safety net program has a lot to do with the climate. And, if you remember several years ago now, there were a lot of climate proposals that were out there, some of which got a lot of attention, some of which also, in my view, I felt like they vilified rural America. I felt like there was a lack of understanding about what it means to be a family farmer and in their climate proposals. So I wrote a plan called the Rural Green Partnership. And I'm proud of it because we wrote it from a rural perspective. We wrote it from a family farm perspective. And in some of those components, things like cover crops and making sure that our family farmers are incentivized to actually look at sustainable farming practices. Some of those were actually adopted by our committee on the climate crisis. Things like biofuels that, you know, perhaps if you live in a great big urban area and you don't know a cornfield from a bean field, you know, they don't understand how biofuels can play into actually helping the environment. You know, I've been singing the tune of biofuels for quite a long time because they reduce emissions. I'm very, very proud of President Biden for allowing E15 to be sold throughout the summer now. Very, very proud of the fact that he addressed what the previous administration had done with these so-called small refinery waivers that were being given out to ExxonMobil and you know, these giant refineries, even though they're defined as small refinery waivers. So, you know, those are all things that, you know, all of that has to be considered, in my opinion, when we're looking at the 2023 Farm Bill and making sure we get our policy, our ag policy, in the right place going forward.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk to you about some other things, but one more crop insurance question before we move on to other subjects. There were some suggestions during the hearing this week about potential expansions for coverage for producers throughout the country, but it's looking like a tight budget situation for the upcoming Farm Bill. Is Congress going to be able to afford to expand crop insurance?
Well, you know, obviously we're getting out of this pandemic. At least let's hope to God we are getting out of this pandemic. I know some numbers are ticking up right now where we had to infuse a lot of extra help into the American, into American families. And obviously we're spending money in a way that allowed us to be able to get on a good side of this pandemic. That said, you know, you can't ignore the fact that you can't just print money and continue to spend in a way that is indiscriminate. So I think everything also has to be looked at through a lens of what can we afford, what is fair to our family farmers, what's going to make sure that we are the preeminent country in the world to feed the world. You know, there's nobody who does farming better than American farmers. And we have to make sure that our policy is in the right place, but also that it's affordable policy.
We'll be right back to discuss the Farm Bill and government funding timelines with Congresswoman Sherry Bustos right after this.
It's not as simple as just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back. The current Farm Bill is set to expire in 2023. When we spoke with Congresswoman Bustos, we asked her about that upcoming timeline and whether or not Congress will be able to write a new bill by the time the current one expires. She says she's optimistic, but it's a little early to tell.
Way too early to predict that. You know, my focus right now, I'm not running for re-election. So on January 3rd of 2023, I am done being a member of Congress. But the reason that I am completely engaged in laying the foundation for the 2023 Farm Bill is because I've got, you know, it's not just because I'm from Illinois where ag is the economic driver of our state. It's not just that I represent close to 10,000 family farms, but it's that we've got to make sure that we're listening now. That's why we're doing these field hearings all over the country, that we do get this in the right place to lay this foundation. If I had anything to say about it, we're looking at this now so we can stay on target and meet the deadlines. So my hope is that will happen. But I think it's way too early to say exactly how that's going to look in 2023.
Mm-hmm. Also this week, we saw the House of Representatives pass a number of appropriations bills. You sit on the Appropriations Committee. We mentioned that end of September timeline for this year. That's a government funding deadline as well. Your thoughts on the progress that Congress is making and whether on the appropriations process, should folks be worried about a government shutdown or will funding be able to be passed in time this year?
Oh gosh, you are the first person that has mentioned shutdown, and I can't even tell you how long, so don't jinx us, okay? But look, we've got 12 appropriation bills. This week, we passed those out of the House, and so we still have six to go. I think there's a couple, the defense appropriations, the Homeland Security appropriations are probably the two where there's still there's still some differences that that we're going to have to take a look at. But we're halfway through right now. We passed all 12 of those appropriation bills out of the committee, and now the six that we just passed out of the House are going to head over to the Senate. So we still have a little bit of work to do, but I'll do a shout out to our chair of the House Appropriations, Rosa DeLauro, out of the state of Connecticut. Just a tremendous chair. She's old school. She gets Democrats and Republicans together to talk about this. I remember when she first became chair, she actually had us all over to her house and invited Democrats and Republicans to sit down over, you know, some wine. I'm not a wine drinker. I drink beer, and she didn't have any beer there for me. So I was completely sober and aware of everything that was going on. But, you know, she had us over for a meal and to sit down and get to know each other. So I have a great appreciation for how she's running this committee. And I know she's dedicated to working across the aisle and really trying to make sure that we stay on target and that obviously that government keeps functioning. Mm-hmm.
I want to borrow on your DCCC experience here with this last question. You said you're on the, you mentioned you're retiring as a member of Congress on the way out, and a number of folks wondering how this midterm election cycle is going to work for the Democratic Party, particularly with some of those suburban and rural districts that were so critical to retaking the House majority for Democrats in 2018. I guess kind of zooming out from the specifics of election year politics, Where do you think the Democratic Party goes from here on its rural outreach in terms of strategy and in terms of messaging?
Well, we have 3 months to go until the November election. And I think here's what I think we'll need to keep an eye out on: what's happening with gas prices. And I think if somebody's filling up their F-150 on the way to the polls and it's costing them $122, we might have to be a little bit concerned. If you're going to the local Hy-Vee grocery store and it's costing you, $10 for a slab of bacon, you know, we still have to be concerned. But President Biden is committed to doing everything he can within his own power to help address the cost of everyday items like, fruits, vegetables, what our family farmers grow. And same thing with the cost of gas. But we have to realize, and this is the part that removes the emotion from it, but We've got this inflation problem all over the world. This is not unique to the United States. And frankly, that is hard to understand when you're spending so much to fill up your truck or your car. That said, tonight is going to be another hearing on the January 6th invasion. I'm talking to you right now from the front of the Capitol where the mob came in and invaded this building. I was on the House floor when that happened. I think it is shining a very, very bright light on some horrible, horrible behavior that compromised our democracy. And I don't know, I can only speak for myself, but there's hardly anything more sacred than making sure that we preserve and protect and do everything we can to make sure our democracy is in a good place. So we'll see how that plays into the election coming up. And then as far as your second part of your question, what do we do in rural America? I ran the strategy, the Heartland Engagement strategy, in the year that we won back, that Democrats won back the majority in 2018. So I've been to every corner of the Midwest. I've been to the congressional district I represent is mostly rural. 85% of the towns in my congressional district that I serve are 5,000 people or fewer. So I get this. I can so-called speak rural. It's how I've lived my life. I'm married to the sheriff of our county. We have three sons, and they're all outdoorsmen. Our oldest son was a champion trap shooter. So, this is a language that I'm very familiar with. But we've got to make sure that even if you live in, L.A. or New York or San Francisco or Chicago or Miami, that there's a deeper understanding about how America has a lot of different components of it. And we have towns that just have 1,000 people or 500 people, and we should make sure that we're showing up there. And more importantly, that when we show up, we use our two ears and our one mouth proportionately, and we just listen to people. And then I think in the end, it's always about delivering results. So listen, turn that into meaningful policy, and then deliver results. And to me, that's the secret to successful politics and successful policy, and that's how we get our nation in a good point.
Congresswoman, thanks for joining us.
All right, thank you.
We'll be right back to hear from our panel, but first, our Haley Bicklehops takes a look at the nation's rail system in this week's Map It Out.
Transportation of all kinds has been a big topic in agriculture in recent months, as farmers and ranchers struggle to both secure inputs and export their products to international markets. Railroad companies are now a big part of the discussion, and Capitol Hill is taking notice. The Association of American Railroads reports there are 7 Class 1 railways which operate throughout the U.S. These railroads account for 94% of America's freight rail revenue and 68% of the country's freight rail mileage. Railroads move about 1/3 of American exports and 60,000 carloads of food and agricultural products every week. Of those 7, the 4 largest are BNSF, CSX Transportation, Norfolk Southern, and Union Pacific. You can see the way their tracks crisscross the country in this map. Worker shortages are plaguing the railroad industry after companies cut back on staff in 2020 because of sudden drops in container traffic. A year later, they were hit with a jump in shipping, and some service slowed down as a result of the growth in demand. In June, 51 members of Congress wrote a letter to the Surface Transportation Board asking for these issues to be addressed. Now, the STB is calling on the companies to develop plans to bring service back to normal. Although the initial plans were due to the board on May 20th, the STB was unsatisfied with the railway's comments and is currently reviewing the company's second drafts. The agency is also having biweekly meetings with the railroads about ways they are easing shipping delays. For more information on the railroad worker shortage and congestion, read Noah Wick's story at agripulse.com. For this week's Map It Out, I'm Haley Bicklehopped.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
The following panel includes gaps in audio caused by technical difficulties. We apologize for the inconvenience. Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we're excited to be joined by this week's panel to continue our discussion on crop insurance and the upcoming Farm Bill. Former House Ag Committee Chair Mike Conaway, joined by Tom Sell with Combust and Sell. I just appreciate all of you taking the time to join us. And Chairman Conaway, I want to go to you first because it's a conversation almost as old as time and as old as farm bills, the debate about whether or not to reform crop insurance, as some people would say, in the upcoming legislation. Wondering your advice to lawmakers looking to protect the program from any potential cuts in the upcoming legislation from some of their more ideological members.
Well, thank you, Spencer, for having me on today. I appreciate that. The great about crop insurance is its long-term success story that we've seen over all these decades, and the increase in covered acres, the increase in value of crops that are covered, and the fact that it does, in fact, work. It provides not only protection for the producers, but also allows bankers and lenders to participate in financing of farm operations in ways they would not be able to were it not for crop insurance. So, a little premature to talk about anything specific that might or might not come up in the 23 Farm Bill, but the long-term history of its success speaks to what needs to be there. One of the things that constantly comes up, especially well this time as a result of all the ad hoc disaster relief that's been in place the last 3 or 4 years, should that supplant or just go that direction? And clearly the answer is no. In fact, you ought to try to, hopefully then we'll try to improve crop insurance to the point that disaster relief that we've experienced over the last 3 or 4 years would be unnecessary or would be a more sustainable and predictable protection for producers as well as bankers and lenders that could be in place. So great story, long-term history of it really working. And the old adage, don't fix something that's not broken, hopefully will prevail.
Bev, I'm bringing you into the fold here. We did see some reports this week with the potential making reforms, seeking capping of premium subsidies. That's one we can probably expect to see others by the time the Farm Bill is ultimately written. I wonder, as you zoom out and just look at the political landscape, how concerned do you think producers should be about the potential for changes to crop insurance in the upcoming Farm Bill?
Well, thanks, Spencer. And I don't know that I would use the word concerned at all. I do think, I mean, of course, the crop insurance program has been a real success story. And I mean, that's a bill that Tom and I worked very closely on, Lothies, more than 20 years ago. So, I think we're both proud of that. What I would say is, you know, when you examine the crop insurance program, and the chairman referenced this, it is a terrific safety net, really, for only a handful of commodity crops, big commodity crops. And there are hundreds of other crops that still have nothing like that. So I think the opportunity is there, certainly, to improve the program in a way that benefits specialty crops. But one area that I've been working a lot in recently is perennial crops and agroforestry. And, you know, frankly, the existing program and the fact that it's, you know, very much an annual program means that there's not a place for those kind of crops in the federal crop insurance program. And not only is there not a place for them, but you know, just the way the program is set up now, it creates a disincentive for farmers to try new crops, whether they're perennial crops or even just adding to their crop rotation and more diversity. The sort of things that we know that they're going to need to do to adapt to a changing climate and to be profitable in the long run. So, I mean, am I concerned about the program being changed in ways that's going to disadvantage farmers? Not at all. I think the opportunity is there to help the program adapt for the future.
Mm-hmm. Tom, we know that there's money is going to be tight in the upcoming Farm Bill, absent some kind of, frankly, act of God to bring new money into the legislation. But if Congress wanted to consider the opportunity to not consider cuts, but consider improvements, consider expansion of crop insurance, Bev talked a little bit about this, but I'd be interested in your thoughts. What are areas that you think Congress could consider on that front?
That's a great question, Spencer. Thanks for allowing me to be here today with two of my favorite people, Chairman Conaway and Bev Paul. I do think God is active and working, and so I think there's a possibility. I think there's a strong possibility, actually, of new money in the next Farm Bill. When you compare the last, you know, 3 or 4 years where we've had $75 billion in outside of the Farm Bill spending to address ad hoc disaster, MFP, and CFAP, and you have none of that captured in the baseline, but you have a situation where if prices were to moderate even some, the current reference prices, as ranking member G.T. Thompson said last week, are irrelevant. So they're going to have to do something. We're also having a disaster again this year, and there's an expectation based on 5 years of ad hoc. So I think it all sets up pretty well to bring some new money into the Farm Bill. But what I love, Chairman Conaway said it well, this program has evolved, has grown. More people are being touched. 450 million acres were covered. But there is still a lot of room for improvement, as Bev said. And now all the commodity organizations or groups experimenting in new and better ways to use the land want to be covered by federal crop insurance. There is a process even within the law that Bev and I worked on these many years ago called 508H. And then there's development authority by RMA as well. And this has been a big part of what Chairman Conaway referred to as the evolution and the growth of crop insurance over time. It's kind of an organic statute that can grow based on demand. And producers actually have a way through 508H to approach the federal government and get a new product that's going to work for them approved. Bev is working on that in some great ways on the conservation front. Our group, SEPA, is working on some new policy. That is one of the beautiful things about crop insurance is it can grow to meet the needs and the demand that's out there.
We'll be right back to talk climate, new money, and more with our panel right after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. Many in farm policy expect the 2023 Farm Bill to be the most climate-focused version of the legislation to date. When we spoke to our panel, we asked Bev her thoughts on what that might mean for crop insurance.
I think there's a lot of energy and a lot of thought going into the existing structure of the crop insurance program and, you know, its mandate for supporting long-term resilience of for farmers and for rural communities. And so, you know, how do those things go together? And Tom talks about the 508H process. You know, I work with the Agree Coalition, and the intersection of crop insurance and conservation is something we've been interested in for a very long time, for the very simple reason of that's where the farmers are. I mean, the crop insurance program, unlike conservation programs, which are wildly oversubscribed, the crop insurance program is open to every farmer. I mean, by law, it's required to accommodate every farmer who wants to buy a policy. A farmer gets to work with a crop insurance agent of their choosing. So it's, you know, it's really, I think, the place where many farmers would like to see the investment and the commitment from the federal government in terms of thinking about long-term adaptation. I will just say that for the Agree Coalition, you know, what we've spent a lot of time over the last decade thinking about these issues. We're really kind of starting to focus in on de-risking the transition to conservation agriculture. And how can that be done? And how do we make sure that the crop insurance program isn't standing in the way of farmers who want to try new crops, new practices in their effort to become sustainable for the long term?
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Connolly, a couple of years ago, you were part of a process that involved writing a farm bill with no new money involved. Wondering from now the outside perspective that you can offer since retiring from the chamber, wondering, does Congress need to think about infusing some new money into this bill?
Well, short answer would be yes, it is. The struggle to write a farm bill under any circumstances is hard, but having new money would make it just a little bit modestly less difficult because you've always got new needs and new competition for resources that are that come into that under that bill. So. New money would be a real boon to the folks who are going to write that farm bill next year or the year after, and would be really important. It will be a struggle because our nation finds running deficit after deficit each year. And so reallocating resources that are otherwise available to the federal government into the farm bill titles would be important, but the struggle will be difficult.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, as we wrap up here, obviously a lot of folks looking to kind of refine their efforts as we go into the Farm Bill, and the Crop Insurance Coalition is no exception. We saw a hearing on Capitol Hill this week to discuss a number of the things the industry wants to accomplish. But generally speaking, how do you assess the health of the Crop Insurance Coalition right now? Are you all going into this process, the agents, the providers, the whole crew, are you all going into this process united, or are there some fractures that need to be healed before you can go to the Hill fully with your recommendations?
Yeah, I feel we're really united. You know, it's a fun industry because it's dynamic. Everyone is competing with one another. That's one of the things that makes crop insurance really great. So among the 13 AIPs, they're all, you know, battling for market share, and agents are trying to do that as well in their own communities. So you have this dynamic, competitive organization that is constantly working to improve their own service. And that collectively improves the work that's being done in rural America. And I think you saw that in the hearing yesterday. There's just a lot of appreciation for crop insurance from the farm groups, from the members of Congress who see it playing such a vital role. Really, it is the safety net at this point. It is the relevant federal policy that is empowering farm families to take the risks they need to plant the crop, to cultivate that crop, hopefully bring it to harvest to feed a hungry world. It is the most relevant farm policy we have right now. And I think the reception on the Hill, the credibility, the goodwill of crop insurance has never been better. And I think the industry is very strong. There are always issues, but there's a, and there's even issues right now, even on the old SRA, some really in the weeds stuff and how agents are paid, particularly affecting agents in specialty crop areas, really undermining their cash flow, which over time will undermine their ability to service some of the communities, especially crop community, what would be termed underserved in crop insurance, some of those communities that we want to reach out to the most. So there are some little issues that need to be fixed, but all in all, I think the industry is very united and the support for crop insurance is very strong.
So obviously we saw that support for crop insurance amongst a pretty bipartisan coalition of lawmakers on Capitol Hill this week. Obviously a lot that that we will be watching as the Farm Bill process continues to unfold. But Tom, Chairman Conaway, and Bev, thanks for joining us here this week. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, Haley Bickelhaupt takes a look at research spending in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
When it comes to public agricultural research and development, the U.S. funding has been relatively flat while other leading countries are boosting their investment. Since 2000, the European Union, Brazil, and India have significantly increased their agricultural R&D spending. However, no country has experienced as rapid an increase as China, which became the largest funder of agricultural R&D after 2011, surpassing the European Union. This chart shows us where the United States stands among its competitors in R&D spending in 2015 inflation-adjusted dollars. Since 2000, China has nearly quintupled its R&D spending, with investments exceeding more than $10 billion in 2015. That's nearly twice the level of spending of the U.S.'s R&D investments, according to the USDA's Economic Research Service, which has full data up to 2015. The U.S. has been a global leader in agricultural production, with China as a major importer of U.S. agricultural goods. Brazil has been on the rise as a foreign competitor in the global corn and soybean markets. Agricultural research spending is expected to be a key priority for many in the upcoming Farm Bill, but a tight budget situation will prove to be a challenge to increasing R&D funds. For this week's Ag by the Numbers, I'm Haley Bickelhaupt.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for next week. USDA will release its annual Farm Production Expenditures Survey on Friday. The International Fresh Produce Association will host its food service conference in California on Thursday and Friday, and sugar industry leaders and stakeholders will be in Colorado for the International Sweetener Symposium. As always, keep an eye on AgriPulse.com for the latest farm policy news in Washington and across the country. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit agripulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.